Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting of the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Houseman?
Present.
Howard?
Present.
Tice?
Present.
McBadgett?
Present.
Bliss?
Present.
Gomez?
Present.
Hassan?
Present.
Heinrich?
Present.
Herr?
Present.
Juergens?
Juergens, present.
Olson?
Present.
Barr?
Present.
And Ryer?
Present.
Madam Chair, we do have quorum.
Thank you. Next order of business is approval of the minutes from Tuesday, March 9. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review the minutes? Representative Howard? Did we lose Representative Howard?
Madam Chair, it looks like he had some internet troubles.
Pardon me?
It looks like he had some internet troubles.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Oh. Is that Representative Gomez? Who just moved? Was that Representative Gomez who moved?
Yes,
it was.
Okay. Representative Gomez moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? If not, if members would unmute yourselves for a voice vote, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. And I will now hand over. If Vice Chair Howard is having problems, can I turn the gavel over to him?
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, so we've got your voice, but just not your face.
Yes, I'll go off video for a second until my internet improves.
All right.
But I am
I'm handing the gavel over to you for the presentation of my bill. Chair Howard, you have the floor.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Would you like to move House File 12?
I will move House File 12, that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Mr. Chair, I also have a DE1 amendment.
Representative Hausman, would you like to move adoption of your amendment?
I will move adoption of my amendment before I present the bill. This is just brings the bill before us. Members, this is one of the obligations we have as we get ready for the end of this executive order we're on, is we need an off-ramp for the eviction moratorium. And the DE1 amendment is our latest version of it. It's still a work in progress. I'm going to be listening to testimony very carefully today. When we get to the end of the eviction moratorium, unless we have an off-ramp that's carefully thought through, how is this going to work? There could be chaos. There could be many people who lose their homes. So we're trying to think as carefully as we can about what language needs to be in place. So that's the DE1 is our current version of it, and it's still a work in progress. So I would move the DE1.
Representative Hausman moves the DE1. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Hausman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. So we need an off-ramp for the eviction moratorium. We're still in a pandemic, and while there are signs of progress, we don't want to take action too quickly. Research in other states shows an increased spread in states that lifted their moratorium in 2020. The executive order has been critical to providing housing stability during the pandemic. It has had its implementation challenges and unintended consequences. For the most egregious violations of leases, this bill allows for additional eviction filings to proceed. We call that material breach with guardrails. That is where our friends are divided. Some think we go too far and some think we don't go far enough with that. And so you'll hear some testimony about that today. Once we're through the public health threat, the off-ramp should provide enough notification. We're suggesting 60 days, and should provide timing for individuals and landlords to have access to the federal COVID emergency rental assistance for non-payment of rent evictions. We're suggesting a 12-month off-ramp after the peacetime emergency powers end. The state has $375 million in emergency rental assistance. So that 12-month period, we're hoping, will allow us and the agency to look to see where that $375 million in emergency rental assistance should go. There is an opportunity to work with the courts to limit the number of evictions filed and to immediately expunge filings that were filed in violation of the emergency orders. As I said, it's a work in progress. I'm going to be listening very carefully to the testimony today. Ms. Mullen, Mary Mullen from Nonpartisan House Research, will give an overview of the bill.
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members of the committee, the DE amendment is labeled DE1, and the first section of this amendment is for actions taken during the peacetime emergency. So as the peacetime emergency continues, it prohibits evictions for residential tenants during the COVID-19 peacetime emergency, except in cases where there has been destruction of rental property, criminal activity, and a substantial breach of the lease. It also prohibits the non-renewal of rent for residential tenants unless the landlord needs to move in family members or for similar circumstances to the eviction, destruction of property, criminal activity, substantial breaches of the lease. This section also prohibits the execution of writs of recovery unless they're compliant with the earlier parts that I just discussed. And it prohibits a termination of a rental agreement for eviction in manufactured homes. And it requires a 7-day notice before you begin the eviction. It also prohibits raising rent more than 6% during the peacetime emergency. Section 2 deals with evictions and non-renewal of leases at the conclusion of the peacetime emergency. This is for the 12 months after the peacetime emergency concludes. And what this section requires is that a landlord provide a 60-day notice before filing an eviction for a residential tenancy. And to not assess late fees during that time. It provides some notice and service requirements that would go into that notice, that the new notice that's required. And it requires the landlord to file that notice when they do the eviction, if they have to proceed to eviction. Section 3 is the section that deals with what happens if the landlord doesn't comply with these requirements. So for Section 1 and 2 of the bill that I just discussed, it allows the court to dismiss an action that isn't complying. And for the 60-day notice, it just requires that has to be filed. And if it isn't filed, then the court can just reject the filing and the person would have to fix it. Section 4 prohibits foreclosures to begin. The process that you begin a foreclosure by advertisement in Minnesota cannot proceed during and then 60 days after the peacetime emergency. It also prevents the termination of a contract for deed during and for 60 days after the peacetime emergency. And that's everything.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Next, we'll move to our testifiers. First up, we have Joey Dobson with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Ms. Dobson?
Good morning, Chair Howard and members. My name is Joey Dobson. I'm an attorney with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Legal Aid Housing Unit represents low-income tenants in eviction cases and other legal matters. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, we were physically in Hennepin County Housing Court with clients every day. We were also able to assist families who came to court with no lawyer. Since the eviction moratorium became effective last March, we have in fact represented over 200 families in eviction cases in Hennepin County. So we know the court process quite well. I would like to just briefly discuss how House File 12 will promote judicial efficiency and make the court process go more smoothly for all parties as we off-ramp from the moratorium. House File 12 puts forward a workable proposal for this off-ramp. It provides a reasonable notice period that gives parties the opportunity to resolve the issue, and in some case, avoiding eviction court altogether. Giving parties a chance to learn what the allegations are against them and potentially cure the problem without the need to court to go to court makes sense. And the notice period aligns well with the likely timeline for renters and landlords both to apply for and, if eligible, receive emergency rental assistance. The court has effectively adapted many of its processes since March of 2020. It has transitioned what were once a high volume in-person court calendars to virtual hearings. We've seen how judicial officers on eviction cases have pretty seamlessly adapted to the new realities of the pandemic. There's every reason to believe that the court would effectively adapt to the provisions in this bill as well. House File 12 provides a logical path for necessary evictions to move forward. And importantly, the bill would allow the rental assistance funding to do what it's intended to do: help maintain stable housing for families who have been hit hard through no fault of their own by the COVID-19 pandemic and current economic recession. There are elements of this proposal we hope might be reconsidered, including providing a notice period for material breach of lease cases once the moratorium is lifted. But as practitioners appearing in court on a daily basis, we would certainly offer our expertise and experience to the author and other stakeholders as this bill moves through the process. Thank you again, Chair Howard and Representative Hausman, for bringing this bill forward. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on this very critical issue.
Thank you, Ms. Dobson. Next up, we have Mike Roth from Homeline.
Good morning. Chair Howard and members, my name is Michael Vra. I'm the managing attorney and hotline director at Homeline, a statewide nonprofit organization whose tenant hotline offers free, confidential legal advice to renters throughout Minnesota. We average over 1,000 households advised per month. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, which is largely a measured plan for transitioning the suspension into statute and later working to prevent nonpayment evictions by requiring a reasonable timeline with clear and detailed notices, as well as allowing expungements when appropriate. This thoughtful approach should help tenants and landlords remedy problems and secure rental assistance to prevent eviction. That being said, this situation presents a critical opportunity to ensure that any off-ramp of Minnesota's eviction suspension is linked to the timely ability to secure rental assistance now and after the peacetime emergency. Homeline has advised thousands of tenants on COVID-19-related rental housing issues, most commonly about lease terminations, evictions, and the need for rental assistance. Most tenants and landlords are complying with executive orders that impact rental housing. However, we have seen efforts to circumvent the eviction process by improperly using eviction suspension exceptions when the primary motivation is due to nonpayment of rent. A shift in what is allowed for eviction and lease terminations before rental assistance is made widely available will lead to more tenants being displaced. We must wait to start an off-ramp until the public health emergency is safely behind us, which this bill mostly accomplishes. However, there is room for improvement in House File Number 12. Here are a few of our key concerns and recommendations. Homeline generally opposes allowing eviction or notices for material violation, breach of the lease, during the public health crisis, as it will lead to displacement, homelessness, and as a result, further negative health outcomes. We are hopeful that the intent behind this legislation is that a violation such as an unauthorized occupant, for instance, who might be a family member who's moved in to help a tenant for healthcare reasons, that that would not be on the same level as seriously endangering the safety of others or causing significant property damage. We think the bill could be improved by carving out more specific exceptions like it already has for nonpayment of rent or fees. For example, the unauthorized occupant should be an exception. Further, on this broader issue, we're concerned that allowing informal notices to terminate or non-renew leases for material violations will mean some landlords use this as an opportunity to effectively terminate for nonpayment of rent. Allowing these informal evictions will end up creating extra judicial displacement of tenants who either do not know their rights or are fearful of disputing such an intimidating notice. Many tenants will simply feel an obligation to move out instead of asserting their right to due process. If a new exception for eviction filing must be added for material violations, an appropriate notice period is essential. Under the proposed bill, it's currently 7 days during the peacetime emergency and 0 days in the 12-month post-emergency period. A reasonable notice period would give tenants time to either remedy situations or choose to find a new home before the eviction is filed. keeping an eviction off their record, and saving the landlord the time and expense of filing in court. On this same point, the notice period for material violation in this bill could end up being shorter for many tenants than the off-ramp bill recently heard in the Senate. House File Number 12 requires 7-day notice, while the Senate bill would create a timeline for evictions for material violation that could be as long as 45 days. Some reasonable notice period is needed both during the peacetime emergency and during the 12-month post-emergency outline in Section 2 of House File Number 12. The bill's inclusion of a 60-day notice post-emergency non-payment of evictions is a good model. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Bra. Next, we have Cecil Smith with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee and Representative Hausman. My name is Cecil Smith. I am president and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. MHA is made up of 1,800 members representing 400,000 housing units in Minnesota. I also own and operate an apartment portfolio myself. MHA respectfully raises our opposition to House File 12 and the adopted DE amendment. This proposal is not an off-ramp. It is a series of two cliffs that divide the eviction cliff contemplated at the end of the peacetime emergency. The first cliff will be when eviction filings are permitted the day after enactment for breaches of lease. The second cliff will be 60 days after the end of the governor's peacetime emergency, when it permits evictions due to non-payment. Alternatively, MHA has provided advice to the legislature and governor on an orderly 5-step process to end the moratorium. Additionally, Minnesota courts have a significant body of case law which has established a judicial definition for material breach of lease. MHA is still evaluating this proposed definition, but we believe it is unnecessary as this is already well defined by the courts on a case-by-case basis. MHA additionally has concerns about Section 1, Subdivision 1F, as it relates to the 1984 statute on rent control prohibitions. In Section 1, Subdivision 1E, prohibiting late fees would clearly be an impairment of contracts under the Minnesota Constitution. Additionally, a blanket automatic expungement is too broad. The proposal extends the existing moratorium into a 12-month period where a 60-day notice must be provided prior to filing an eviction or lease termination for non-payment. A 60-day notice is twice as long as any other notice period in the United States and over four times longer than any other legislation previously considered in this committee. This is counterproductive to housing market stability, as it could put more small operators at risk for another 12 months following the 12 months they have already endured. The best way to ensure housing stability is to get the rental assistance program running effectively. With $100 million from the CARES Act, $375 million from the CAA, and approximately $300 million more coming from the American Rescue Plan Act, we have an abundance of funding to ensure housing stability for most renters. The agency has these incredible resources available to them and should efficiently take applications and get the checks in the mail to property managers. Unfortunately, I'm disappointed to report that I am still waiting for a rent check, which was promised to my renter through the CARES Act CHAP program in December rent, for December rent. Yes, December rent. We're in March. My resident regularly asked me if I have received it, but the answer is still nothing yet. This promise of rent assistance from the government for this singular resident is not a strain on our business. However, the same cannot be said for my resident, who bears the stress of lingering unpaid rent. Finally, we continue to evaluate the proposal as we have had limited time since it was only provided yesterday. But it is apparent that this bill is unfortunately attempting to advance a set of tenant-landlord policy issues which are in no way relevant to ending the eviction moratorium. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Next, we have Paul Egger from the Minnesota Realtors. Mr. Egger.
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Egger, and I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. We have membership of over 21,000 real estate professionals in every corner of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We're still reviewing the details of the DE amendment, but we appreciate the time to share some of our initial thoughts today. When renters struggle to pay rent, housing providers often struggle to keep properties afloat. The longer the eviction moratorium is in place without a plan for an orderly and reasonable process for emerging from it, the more difficult the transition will be. While we appreciate Chair Hausman beginning this discussion, we do not see how House File 12 would provide for an orderly process for ending the eviction moratorium and transitioning back to practices dictated by current law. Rental assistance has been and will continue to be critical to both tenants and housing providers in the coming months and should be a significant factor in facilitating the transition from the eviction moratorium. In the last federal COVID-19 relief bills you heard from Mr. Smith, Minnesota received $375 million for rental assistance, which will hopefully be going out beginning later this month. In the bill passed yesterday by Congress, there's another $21.5 billion for rental assistance. And we are also pleased that that bill includes almost $10 billion for homeowner assistance. Those dollars represent an important tool to help build a bridge from where we are today to the post-eviction moratorium period ahead. However, House File 12 does not attempt to leverage those rental assistance dollars to craft a phased off-ramp that could begin sooner while also minimizing impacts on both tenants and housing providers. Finally, Mr. Chair, I just want to cite a couple of additional items. We do not support rent control policies either and are concerned with the language that's in the bill on page 2, lines 18 through 20. And also, Mr. Chair, the foreclosure and contract for deed cancellation section seems to be an expansion on the existing executive order and a new requirement we would like to understand the implications of as the bill moves forward. In particular, how it may affect the ability to access and maintain vacant foreclosed properties to ensure those properties do not deteriorate. Thank you again for the opportunity to share some initial thoughts regarding the language in the DE amendment, and we may have additional comments after further review and discussion with our members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. Next, we have Larry McDonough from Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. Mr. McDonough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for having me testify today. I'm going to share my screen for a very brief slideshow. I'm here to talk about current economic and public health data on tenants. Can you see my screen? Okay.
Yes, we can see it.
All right. So this is a slideshow I've been doing for some time before the Senate as well. I'm just going to go right into it. As Representative Hausman mentioned, there's a lot of data out there on how eviction moratoriums are saving lives, and the untimely expansion of evictions is causing deaths. When you look at kind of the worst offender, it's Texas. It's estimated that over 4,000 deaths occurred by opening up their evictions too early during high infection rates. The estimate for Minnesota lives saved over the summer, around 680 lives. Those were when our numbers were much lower. When you look at the numbers of infections that happened in the fall that were quite a bit higher than deaths we had in the summer, my estimate based on a review of the literature is our eviction suspension has saved around 2,000 lives in Minnesota through January 4. Evictions before the pandemic, I've got them listed out here, approximately 6,000 statewide, and you can see some of the breakdown by county, and I will email my slideshow to Owen when I'm done. So we've got about, you know, a year's worth of evictions on hold. Hard to say exactly how many are on hold since some cases have resolved, but we have to look at the economy as well to see what kind of numbers we might be looking at. Unemployment is still high in Minnesota. It's up from where it was before the pandemic, but more importantly, cumulative unemployment applications tell us a story that when you look at the accumulation of unemployment applications during the pandemic, we see that anywhere from a third to two-thirds of the population in a county has filed for unemployment at some point. That's relative to the labor force. And when you look at census data, and this is data that was released yesterday, the census have been releasing estimates on a weekly basis throughout the pandemic by state, by interviewing tenant households, and the numbers here are staggering. When you look at over 100,000 estimated to not be caught up in the rent, over 200,000 estimated to be unemployed, almost 400,000 estimated to have had a loss of income of a household member, over 100,000 estimated to have little confidence that they're going to pay the next month's rent, and around 65,000 thinking very likely that they'll have to leave in the next couple of months. When you compare all that with 16,000 in a normal year annual evictions, this data supports that the number of evictions on hold right now well exceed the annual number. And this number of evictions, unless they're really staggered over a long period of time, would overwhelm legal services, housing attorneys, and the courts. And, you know, these numbers are consistent with national estimates for Minnesota, estimating evictions being anywhere from when they're opened up, anywhere from 30,000 to perhaps 280,000. And so, you know, I agree that it's time to plan, and there's a lot to like in this bill. I agree with Mr. Bra that the expansion of evictions should wait until the economic and health data support it. And so that we shouldn't be expanding evictions now, but we should be looking at essentially an off-ramp to expand evictions when the data supports it. And along with that, funding financial assistance for tenants and landlords, for industries that employ tenants, for shelters and emergency assistance programs, but also legal aid and mediation programs and more resources for the courts. I mean, if the courts are going to be looking at perhaps 12 times or more the monthly evictions when evictions open up, they're going to be swamped as well. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to testify. I hope this is helpful, and I'll email these slides to Owen in a few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDonough. That concludes the list of testifiers that signed up ahead of time. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? If not, we'll open it up for questions for members. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am also on a different computer since mine seems to not be working. But I just have several things. I was hopeful that we could get things moving a little bit sooner, but it doesn't appear that we are. I'm not really excited about that, because I think that the longer we kick the can down the road, the longer we're kicking the can down the road. I've been looking through some of the emails that I've received, and it's like, wow. We're going to be in a world of hurt, and I really feel like we're on a path as well to basically get rid of a lot of our housing providers that can't afford to do this, and that really scares me. I've mentioned that before, but I also look at some of these. Well, I would say we're looking at potentially 15 months that we're not doing anything, and that makes me feel like we're really just not addressing the issue and just letting it go. And that doesn't make me feel good. I would tell you that in the, what was it, 2010, 2011, when we had the recession, one of the things the builders would tell you that they would have been a lot better off if they just would have been allowed to fail and start over. And I kind of feel like maybe we're in a place where maybe that's what we need to do, is start over. But tying the hands of owners, housing providers, is not going to help at all. In my estimation, I look at a lot of the folks I know and how much money they're down. They're not going to be able, just from one person. I mean, we're talking some people haven't paid anything for a year, $25,000, whatever it is, and then not being allowed to do anything. But I think the thing that really makes me the most nervous is the rent controls, and I can't as a landlord, I just can't do that. There are different things that happen, and sometimes it comes from different changes in the city and what they say and what they do and the fees that they charge and what they're doing, and it just pushes the rent up, and many of us can't afford to do that, not now. I will tell you that my checkbook is not as healthy as it had been at some times. And I have renters that are really good about paying. But there's a lot of repairs and stuff and damage that's happened. You know, I would say with kids, because they've been home so much and they haven't been going to school. And there's a lot of frustrations. We've seen fences broken. We just replaced, I think I talked about, a driveway and some other things. But we are seeing, we're feeling this as well as anybody else, that we're just, how do we keep going? And we're talking about how many deaths because of COVID, but I guess my question is, just from the folks I've been talking to and hearing about, you know, how many deaths do we have of these housing providers and just business people who can't afford to go another day, who just can't do it. I've been hearing about suicides a lot more, and that's really scary to me. I don't think this is opening up. I'm really fearful that we're going to lose a lot of our housing because they're not going to do it. They want to be able to work on this sooner than later, not kick the can down the road. And I will tell you that evictions are the only time that we go through evictions are when it's so egregious, we just can't afford to do it, and it's not healthy and it's not safe. We just can't. And I just, again, I think that we have to figure out what the off ramp is sooner than later. I talked to Ryan. Again, I don't have my computer, so I'm like totally blanking out on his last name. I talked to him yesterday, and I was really hopeful. And then I read the deed, and I'm like, no, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work for a lot of my folks. And I can't support it right now, and I wish I could, because I think there's a lot that we can do. I really think that starting earlier than later is a great way to start, but not when you put rent controls in for housing providers, because there's a lot of things out there. We're tying their hands more and more and more and expecting more and more from them. And we just can't anymore, guys. People just cannot do this anymore. They are at a tipping point. They are a breaking point. It's been a year. And so many things are happening, and they just are not ready to deal with it. But to do this is really tying people's hands. And I would say it's also tying renters' hands, too, because they're not able to live where maybe they want to live, because they're just not going to find it. I really am so fearful about what's going to happen to our market. We've seen it in housing. I've seen it and lived through it. And this is, to me, feels the same way, but in fact, it feels a lot worse. And so I really hope that we can talk about this a little bit more. I think there's a lot more we can do, and asking our housing providers, you know, what their opinions are, because I'm not thinking they wrote this. I'm not thinking it at all. I think the agency did after talking to Ryan, and I understand it. I understand why some of these things are here, but I don't think they're in the best interest of anyone. I really think a lot of our folks are looking, how do they open up? How do they do things? How do they get their rents? I mean, $25,000 for a person in St. Cloud is a lot of money. And that's just one out of how many in that building. Most people have been really great. I haven't heard about any additional evictions. They don't feel like that's been a problem. They've been able to work through some of this. It's the ones that aren't paying anything at all. And then you're saying we can't get rid of them. That's hard, because that's my money to take care of everybody else. That's all I'm going to say for now. But I really think we've got more work to do. I don't think this does it. I really don't. I don't think it's in the best interest for the housing providers, and I think those are the people that we really need to look at right now, because it's been hard. They've been struggling. They've been making it work. But this is almost too much. I think this is way too much for a lot of those housing providers to endure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tice. And just one question, and maybe Mr. Smith might be able to answer this on the notion of increased rent or late fees. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Smith, but did your organization not send guidance to folks during the pandemic requesting that they would not increase late fees or rent?
So, yes, Mr. Chair. Before the governor issued his order, we took upon ourselves as an industry to issue guidance to members that for the period until May of 2020, May 31st, 2020, we were advising members to not charge late fees, not issue any new rent increase notices, to work with the residents on seeking rental assistance as we were coming to grips with the reality that we were facing a public health emergency and a pandemic and really historic times. So that was issued at the outset for a period of 3 months.
Thank you, Mr. Smith, and thanks for doing that. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 2 of the bill, I believe it is, extends the moratorium for 12 months following the end of the peacetime emergency. When will that be? When is the peacetime emergency going to end?
Representative Hausman, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, I think we don't know yet because Dr. Osterholm is to be believed, he keeps predicting there's going to be a second surge this summer, which we hope he's wrong, but we just pay attention to what's happening in the pandemic.
Thank you. And that's true. And don't mean to put you on the spot, Representative Hausman, but the reality is we don't know. This is indefinite. Representative Teich talks about kicking the can down the road, and it's not just kicking it down for a couple of months or even a year. It's indefinite at this point because we have no idea when the peacetime emergency is going to end. And the governor has never told us what specific numbers he's looking at so that we can even gauge if we're getting close to that date or not. So to me, this is a noble attempt because nobody wants to be putting people out on the street in the middle of a pandemic. But the reality is there are those tenants that are gaming the system. I have one constituent who is a landlord. He owns maybe 6 or 8 properties, single family homes and duplexes. And just one of those properties, he was out $25,000 in rent. And then the tenant trashed the place, causing about $10,000 worth of damage, and then he left. What recourse does that landlord have? And I guess I'll leave that as a question to whoever can answer it. What recourse does a tenant, does a landlord have in this situation?
Chair, I will say that Ryan Baumtug from Minnesota Housing is on the call for questions, and I would just invite him to weigh in with observations of either of the comments being made.
Mr. Baumtrag.
Mr. Chair, Representative Juergens, the question about if a renter has left and caused damage, I believe the only action, although I look to our policy attorney if I get this wrong, she's also on the phone, Lil Robertson, is through the courts. The program that the agency is working on as fast as we can that was authorized at the end of December, the COVID-19 Emergency Rental Assistance Program, the federal requirements do require a landlord to allows a landlord to apply, but a renter will need to sign and be a part of that application. And so there is a challenge with utilizing the new resources where there isn't an opportunity for housing stability to occur with the resources. I will say that the agency, as we're working to understand the program with the Treasury guidance that was updated the last week of February, we are looking for opportunities to make landlords as whole as possible. Other states I see have decided to only pay 80% of the debt a renter owes. The state is not contemplating that. If a landlord has not received payments, we are intending to pay the entire amount that is due and not prorate. And a number of other states, it looks like, are prorating. So we are looking for ways that where we can within the federal program to satisfy the complete rent owed for a renter, but appreciate that in some circumstances, the program will not be able to pay that rent if they're no longer living there.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair, to Mr. Baumtrog.
Go ahead, Representative Juergens.
Can a landlord collect past due rent after an eviction?
Mr. Baumtrog, or maybe Ms. Robertson?
Yeah, Chair Howard, if I could defer that to Lil Robertson, our policy attorney, I'd appreciate that, Representative Juergens.
Ms. Robertson.
Good morning, Chair Howard and Representative Juergens. To answer your question about whether or not a landlord can collect rent after someone has moved out, they can. Typically, they have the avenue of going through the courts, usually with a small claims court, depending on how much they're asking for. A landlord could take a tenant to small claims court and recoup or get a judgment for the amount of money that's owed.
Representative Juergens, any follow-up?
Well, just, you know, so many of these programs, and again, I understand the reasoning why we put the moratorium in place, to help primarily the lower income individuals, the renters that are already struggling to pay the rent and the lower incomes. Many years ago, I had a job for a while as a bill collector, and you know how many times I heard you can't get blood from a turnip? And that's really what we're talking about in many of these cases. When the only answer or the best response is to pursue it through the courts, a lot of these landlords aren't going to waste their time because they know that collecting on that in many cases is just not going to happen. So unfortunately, in trying to help a segment of our population, we're really harming another segment of our population. One tenant or one landlord that I know, he attributed it. He said, this is basically the state of Minnesota has stolen money from me, is the way he views it. And so many times, you know, we try to, in many of the policies in this body, we try not to have unintended consequences. And unfortunately, I think in this case, trying to help so many people, we're hurting others, and that's the unintended consequences. And I don't see a good recourse for many of them. So I'll just leave my comments there. I think that we do need a good off-ramp. I can't support this bill as it is today, though. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Juergens. Next, Representative Olson on the list. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say kind of from a different perspective that whole idea of why it's so hard. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for what we're trying to accomplish to protect people who have nothing. I hear when you can't collect from somebody or the challenges, I hear people that their only safety net may be a homeless shelter, or it may be the streets, or it may be a variety of other dangerous circumstances. And so, you know, that's, I guess, where I go to and think about what are we trying to accomplish here for the people that have nothing. They don't have assets to sell off. They don't own multiple properties. They are literally at ground zero looking down some pretty bleak circumstances. And so I'm glad we're being intentional in thinking about what we're doing here. And also kind of hear us talking across each other right now. Because when I heard Commissioner Baumtrog talk, I heard about money that will go to landlords. And for me, that sounds like a win-win situation, that we're talking about the money that's coming from the federal government that the agency will have will go to help renters and landlords. And that seems like such a win-win. And so I think we need to maybe reframe the conversation about how do we view what we're doing as a mutually beneficial piece. And I think we've got the framework here that we're talking about that gets us in that direction. And we're talking about the funds that are coming from the federal government that can help with that. And if I'm reading this right, and maybe the bill author can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's also nothing in this section that would reduce the amount of rent or stop a landlord from collecting rent. We don't prohibit that in the language in front of us either. So just wanted to say those comments, and if I need to be clarified on any of that, feel free, Chair Hausman, too. So thank you.
Thanks, Representative Olson. Representative Hausman, a comment there?
She is correct. That is the intention. It occurs to me that it might help. I have a question for Mr. Bomcock. We intentionally, with that first $100 million, wanted it to go directly to landlords because we wanted the rent to be paid. And maybe Mr. Bomcock could just comment on, did that work? Were we able to do that?
Mr. Bomcock.
Chair Howard and Representative Hausman, the COVID housing assistance program that you mentioned was a $100 million program that utilized the coronavirus relief funds. It was the largest housing assistance program per capita. As you heard from Mr. Smith earlier, the program, when it ended in December, the last week of the program, the agency received requests for $35 million and over 14,000 applications in the last week of the program. With the remaining administrators that we had left, it put a lot of pressure on them to get it out, hence some delays in processing. So the program worked in that it was one of the largest in the country. It got resources to landlords to satisfy debt owed. We know that there's room to improve with the new program. There's a different processing component that the agency is considering. We used local administrators, over 52 local administrators to process and do all the intake, processing of payments, due diligence, getting required information from landlords, verifying it with households. We're going down a different path for the new program with the goal of expediting payments because we know more timely payments is critical to landlords to pay their bills as property tax bills are coming due, as another month of rent may come up. So we know we have room to improve on the processing payments and we're trying to take steps with the new program. It is a new program. It has new rules of the road. It has more federal requirements. But we do think that providing resources directly to landlords to satisfy the debts on behalf of renters is a successful way to provide housing stability and help landlords pay their bills.
Thank you. Are there any other further questions for the bill author or for any of the testifiers? If not, I'm going to make one comment myself and then turn it over to Representative Hausman. You know, I appreciate the discussion and the testimony today. And kind of as Representative Olson reframed for us, I think what this bill is after is that win-win, where we acknowledge that this pandemic has been supremely unfair to so many people. And our goal is to make sure that renters have the resources they need, the stability they need, that landlords are made whole, and that we prevent a wave of evictions that we know would be crippling to Minnesotans. And that's the point I just want to recenter us on, is just how impactful an eviction is for Minnesota families. We know from data that just having an eviction filed for Minnesotans impacts the health of an expecting mother. It impacts the health and social wellness of children. An eviction filing is linked to increased depression and anxiety amongst children and families. Data shows that it's linked to permanent, potentially, poverty and increased chronic homelessness. The job security and almost every single person that is evicted finds themselves in a worse housing situation as a result, and sometimes for a number of years or decades. And of course, we know that these evictions are disproportionately harming our communities of color. And so, you know, when we think about how this pandemic has been unfair to folks, the folks that I'm thinking about when we consider this bill are, you know, the workers in our service industry that lost their job and have fallen behind, frontline workers that have balanced their well-being for low-wage jobs, parents that have maybe chosen to quit their job to help their students or their kids with online learning and fallen behind. And we just simply cannot allow this pandemic to condemn these Minnesotans to poverty that very well may be permanent. And so really, you know, this bill before us, to me, says not on our watch. We are not going to let that happen to Minnesotans. We are not going to allow this pandemic to dictate the trajectory of their lives. And so I really appreciate Representative Hausman bringing it forward and know that we have some work to do on it and look forward to a legislative solution. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, very much. And thank you to all the testifiers, to all of the members and the comments you've made. I've listened very carefully. For the testifiers, if your testimony is in writing, I would really appreciate getting copies of everyone's comments because all of it helps us. In the best of all possible worlds, this is what I'd like to have happen now, that all testifiers could sit around a table with me and look for agreement, look for that win-win. That's the one part of our process that I so miss, where we gather and work together. To your comments, Mr. Chair, that is what started all of this. I can remember the first time I talked about this, the first people to lose their jobs were the workers in bars, restaurants, and retail. And we know what their salary level is. And we know they're the workers who probably are one paycheck away from not being able to pay their bills. And that's what at that moment, we didn't want any more homeless people at the time of the pandemic. That's kind of started us down this road. But now we have to look for the way out. So I just continue to invite everyone to share their thoughts. This is, as I said, a work in progress. It goes to the Judiciary Committee. There are lawyers there who might also help us with some of the remaining issues. But again, thank you, members and testifiers, for your advice.
Madam Chair, would you like to renew your motion?
I will renew my motion that House File 12 is amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Civil Law.
Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Howard?
Aye.
Hausman?
Aye.
Tice?
No.
McBadgett?
Aye.
Bliss?
No.
Gomez? Gomez?
Aye.
Hassan?
Aye.
Heinrich?
Heinrich, no.
Herr?
Aye.
Juergens?
Juergens, no.
Olson?
Aye.
Barr?
No.
And Ryer?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, that is 8 ayes and 5 nays.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. The bill has passed and moves to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And with that, I will transition our virtual gavel back to Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have two more bills, both by Representative Hassan, House File 1417. I think you're on mute.
And I'm also having internet issues, so if my screen goes blank, I will still continue to talk, but my internet is just a mess. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 1417, which is an act relating to housing.
And you're moving that bill?
Oh, I'm supposed to move it first, right? Yes, Madam Chair. I move House File 1417 before the committee and to be and for possible inclusion.
Thank you. To your bill.
Okay. Hopefully nothing else goes wrong. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 1417, which is an act relating to housing, appropriating money to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for the Workforce Home Ownership Program. Minnesota has one of the highest rates for home ownership in the nation, but one of the largest disparities in ownership rates between whites and BIPOC households. Apart from the historic, systemic, and institutional factors that have contributed to that disparity, it's also amplified that by the fact that we simply do not have enough homes on the market to provide adequate affordable ownership opportunities. The Workforce and Affordable Home Ownership Program provides competitive grants to increase the supply of affordable home ownership opportunities
across the state. This bill is part of the Home Ownership Minnesota efforts to secure increased funding to develop 500 units of entry-level affordable housing a year. Currently, less than 4% of the funds allocated by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency are used to develop ownership housing. Minnesota has the worst home ownership racial disparities gaps in the country, and it's worse now than it was in 1980. There are about 61,000 Black, Indigenous, and families of color who could afford to buy homes, but there is no inventory of entry-level homes. Currently, there are also 29,000 families who could buy home that could that occupy rental units that would serve families earning 30% AMI. Investing in creating a unit affordable home costs less than 30% of that creating of a rental unit. And with that, Madam Chair, I believe I have a testifier on the call.
It looks like we have two testifiers. Kathy Wetzel-Mastell is first.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hassan. I am Kathy Wetzel-Mastell with PRG. PRG is part of the Home Coalition, and we are also one of the state's largest producers of mortgage-ready buyers. Buyers who are increasingly thwarted in their search for a home that they can afford. In fact, we are producing many more mortgage-ready buyers than there are entry-level homes to buy. PRG also builds a very limited number of ownership units each year. Last year, it was 9 units. This year, we had one on the market with offers due today, and we received 7 offers for that one house and turned away at least that many who did not meet the eligibility requirements. As I mentioned, I'm also representing the Homeownership Minnesota Coalition as co-chair. The other co-chair is Kristen Insidi of Habitat Minnesota. That coalition is 13 organizations from across the state, representing nearly 75% of Minnesota counties. Our vision is that homeownership is viewed and resourced as a critical component of solving the affordable housing crisis and addressing our significant racial wealth disparities. Collectively, we are experts in the preparation of home buyers, the production and preservation of affordable ownership opportunities. Those of us who produce new units are doing so at high rates to BIPOC buyers. In Greater Minnesota, that's in excess of 50%, and in the metro, in excess of 80%. We know that homeownership positively impacts health and education outcomes, and it is also the primary driver of wealth creation for most low and moderate income Americans. Homeowners have 44 times the wealth of renters, and it is this wealth, as you know, that allows families to invest in higher education, small business creation, and homeownership for future generations. House File 1417 focuses on production, as the lack of inventory disproportionately impacts BIPOC buyers and has surpassed credit and down payment as the primary barrier in addressing the racial homeownership gap. Cianne Thomas, a realtor with deep knowledge of the market and its impact on narrowing the racial homeownership disparity, will address the problem of inventory in more detail in a few minutes. But I want to spend a few minutes talking about where we are now. The state of Minnesota funds fewer than 100 ownership units per year. In 2020, it was 92. At the same time, as Representative Hassan mentioned, we've got families who could afford ownership occupying existing rental units that are affordable at less than 30% AMI. In fact, we have a lot of those families. Of the 120,000 units that are affordable exist today to families earning less than 30% AMI, these are rental units, fully a quarter or 30,000 are occupied by families who could afford ownership if there were inventory to purchase. This bill has bipartisan support, as more than half of those units occupied by families who could afford to buy yet affordable to families earning less than 30% are located in greater Minnesota. Given that a unit of ownership housing requires a state investment of just one-third of that that's needed in an affordable rental unit, it makes good fiscal sense, too. I heard yesterday that there was a need for 64,000 units affordable at less than 30% AMI. And I just want to reiterate that we could address that at just one-third the cost by increasing ownership production. Excuse me, we could address nearly one half of that need by increasing ownership production. There's also an economic development impact in developing ownership housing that is rarely found in rental housing, and that is who benefits from the construction contracting process. In the last 10 years, just three of PRG's more than 115 construction contracts have been awarded to white male-owned businesses. We've had an affordable housing crisis for years, and our racial homeownership gap, as Representative Hassan noted, is as bad now, perhaps a titch worse, than it was in 1980. If we're ever going to address the shortage of affordable housing and begin to eliminate the racial homeownership gap, we need to focus on strategies that move people along the housing continuum, and building 500 units of affordable ownership annually is a cost-effective way to do that. A $10 million appropriation into the Workforce Homeownership Fund is a step in the right direction and would result in more than double the homeownership production. That is all I have. Thank you so much for your time. I'm happy to take questions now or after CN's comments.
We have CN Thomas from ABC Realty with us. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, thank you, Chair Hausman. I'm C.N. Thomas. I am the owner and broker of a small boutique real estate company. Can you guys hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, great. And I work primarily in the urban core, and I do a lot of work with BIPOC families and buyers. I also represent Dayton's Bluff Neighborhood Housing Services on the sale of their affordable housing product. And we are seeing the shortage of inventory play out on a daily basis with our projects. We get, minimum 3 to 10 purchase agreements on each and every project that comes to market. We can't produce the inventory fast enough to meet the demand. And I just wanted to share with you, some stats that just came out today in our marketplace, and the average sale price is up 10.5%. It's now average sale price is $319,813 for a bread and butter property, while the median sale price is also up by 10.6%. And new listings coming to the market now are down by 14.8%, down to 6,184 units. And homes for sale year over year has dropped by 51.6%. So that's the data, and that's the reality that we are living in now. And we are, it's getting so competitive. Buyers are now having to consider waiving an inspection contingency to be more competitive as they, try to navigate a multiple offer scenario. And I would never advocate a buyer buy without an inspection contingency, but that's where we are today with regard to the fierce competition in the marketplace. So we definitely have a chronic shortage of bread and butter properties for first-time home buyers, for home buyers of color. They are feeling the pinch of this lack of inventory. So I would advocate, yeah, whatever we can do to create more affordable housing, that's what we need.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Thomas. Members, do we have questions of either the bill author or the testifiers? Mr. Worth, I don't see any hands. Am I missing anyone?
Madam Chair, there is nobody in the queue.
Representative Hassan, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Home ownership is about wealth creation, it's about neighborhood stabilization, and it's about equity. And I kindly ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. House File 1417 will be laid over. Representative Hassan, you have a second bill, House File 1870.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And you want to move your bill?
Yes, I move House File 1870 before the committee and a possible inclusion for the omnibus bill.
Representative Hassan, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 1870, which is an act relating to housing, open access connection, voicemail services, funding provided, and money appropriated. Homelessness impacts us all, whether or not we experience it ourselves. Homelessness is a public health issue. It's an economic issue. And most of all, homelessness is human tragedy. Our own community members living in tents under bridges, vulnerable to inclement weather and violence, is stripped of dignity and our collective respect. I used to work in Hennepin County as a social worker with population that have dual diagnosis and experiencing homelessness. My biggest challenge was getting hold of individuals. If someone does not have a place that they call home or an address that you can send a letter or a phone number where you can call them, how would you ever find them? I'm supporting this bill because I think that when someone is experiencing homelessness or is having, you know, issues with finance, there should be a way that the county workers can get hold of them or their care providers can get hold of them, or even if they applied for a housing advocates can get hold of them, as well as if they apply for a job. The company that they applied from that job can leave a message. Here are some numbers on how to highlighting the importance of this project. In a typical year, this agency provided a free voicemail to 2,700 people. 1,200 people are on the community voicemail system at any given time. 94% of the voicemail users are unemployed. 73% of them are homeless. 28% are parents receiving MFIP, which is Minnesota Family Investment Program. 63% of the voicemail users are looking for housing, and they're able to find housing if they have a phone number where people can call and leave a voicemail. And 60% of the voicemail users are looking for employment, and they're able to find employment if there is a place where people can leave a voicemail and they can call them back. This agency has partnered up with 315 nonprofit and government agencies to distribute free voicemail services. 40 of these partnering agencies are located in Greater Minnesota. 19% of the voicemail users are under the age of 25. 52% are aged between 26 to 44. 26% are the age 45 to 59, and 3% are over the age of 60. And 66% of the voicemail users are considered BIPOC, 12% are disabled, and 7% are veterans. With those numbers, Madam Chair, it highlights that the people who use these services are across all walks of life. With that, Madam Chair, I believe I have one or two testifiers to tell us their story.
I have Manuel Moore from Open Access Connections, but I do see a different name on the screen. Is Manuel Moore here?
So my name is Mark Erpelding. I'm the executive director of Open Access Connections.
So we've got a substitution. So please identify yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. My name is Mark Erpelding. I am the executive director of Open Access Connections. I also do have Manuel Moore with me as well. We're just sharing an office space right now, so he can speak after I'm done speaking, if you would wish to hear from him.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Thank you everyone on the committee for considering our bill for appropriation. My name is Mark Rippleding. I'm the executive director of Open Access Connections. Open Access Connections is a nonprofit organization that's been providing free community voicemail since 1994. Each year, we provide this simple, cost-effective tool to 2,700 homeless and low-income Minnesotans. We are able to assign a community voicemail to a person in need in under 10 minutes. And upon completing registration, they are provided a phone number that they can immediately put on resumes, housing applications, give to friends and family. Individuals are able to access their messages through any phone, which provides convenience and accessibility to our clients that are so often unstably housed. As you can imagine, it is almost impossible for a person in today's society to conduct a successful job search without a phone number. If they are completing a standard online job application, they are literally unable to submit their job application without first entering a phone number. The importance of a community voicemail number can be summed up by one of our clients, who said, "All the years that I was homeless, community voicemail was the only reliable communication I had to reach employers, respond to jobs, communicate with relatives, and receive messages from doctors. This is definitely a necessity if you don't have a landline phone or a cell phone. I recommend, and for anyone that is homeless, it is a necessity." This funding appropriation provides the basic funding for our organization. Approximately 30% of our budget comes from this appropriation. Our remaining budget comes from 10% individual contributions, 10% additional government sources, and 50% from local foundations. Although we are always on the lookout for additional sources of revenue, funding from government agencies and foundations is incredibly competitive and increasingly limited. Loss of this funding would quickly put our organization on an unsustainable path. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to speak about Open Access Connections and our community voicemail program. Supporting this appropriation will ensure that all Minnesotans have the basic phone access tools needed to succeed.
Thank you, Mr. Erbolding. Emmanuel Moore, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes.
I'll just come on over. All right.
Good afternoon. Do you see me?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Manuel Moore, and I'm with Open Access Connections. And I've had the voicemail for 10 years. I was homeless for 5 years. One thing, when you're homeless, you lose everything. Phones, friends, everything. But I was able to obtain housing just by the mere fact that I had a number where they could call me for an interview to come in and get housing, which I have now. But I've had my voicemail for 10 years, even though I have a cell phone, which is broken and don't work half the time. The voicemail is a number I can call from any phone and get all my messages from family, not just work and jobs and housing, but I've utilized it for 10 years. And without it, I don't know where I would be today. So I'm just saying it's a great program, and I support it 100%.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, are there questions of either the bill author or the testifiers? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably, well, maybe either a question for Manuel or Mr. Erbolding. You said you had a phone now. Are there programs where you can get a phone?
There's a program that Open Access offers, but it requires you have to pay $50 to get the phone, but you get the free, you get free service for a year. But sometimes if you don't have no income, it used to be a free phone, but it's not free anymore. So the only option I had was to keep my voicemail. So, yeah.
Jump in.
Mark.
Mr. Erbolding.
Yes. Thank you so much for that question. There is a federal program called the Lifeline Program that is administrated from the Federal Communications that also provides subsidized phone services, oftentimes via landline or cell phone services. And we are obviously very supportive of those programs. Unfortunately, because it is a federal program, there are a lot of restrictions to that program. You need to have an ID. You need to have proof of low-income eligibility. You need, oftentimes, you need to pay a one-time fee for the device. And a lot of the people that we serve are really in a crisis, and they may not have all of that proper documentations to complete the federal application. So community voicemail continues to serve as an incredible safety net for someone in an immediate crisis so they can get back on their feet.
Follow up, Representative Tice.
Yes, I would love to. Thank you, thank you, Chair Halsman. So if I had extra phones, is it beneficial to keep them and, like, you know, bring them to you so that you would have them? Or is that just not something you want to do?
Mr. Erpelding.
So we do also distribute some cell phones through the Lifeline program. This bill is appropriate or completely separate from that. We would possibly accept 4G T-Mobile phones that might be able to swap out. But the problem that we have isn't necessarily so much the device. That's a one-time thing that a lot of people are able to stomach. It's the ongoing monthly service, which oftentimes you can get a monthly service for $30 a month, but the phone you can find for $30 as well. It's the ongoing expense that is really troublesome for these high-stress, low-income clients.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Worth, am I missing any hands?
Madam Chair, there are no other hands up at this time.
Representative Hassan, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for indulging this conversation, and thank you to the testifiers. For someone who has seen how much this this program helps at firsthand experience working with folks who are highly mobile or homeless and are, you know, trying to apply for housing, apply for jobs, apply for medical insurance. This is a really good program, and it's a very important program. I hope you can support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. House File 1870 is laid over. Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, March 16 at 10:30 a.m. There being no other business before us, we are adjourned.